Welcome back to the Burn Bag Podcast. My name is Ryan Rosenthal, joined as always by my co-host Andre Ganuela. And today we are deeply honored to be joined by Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin. Congresswoman Slotkin represents Michigan's 8th District. Her committee assignments include the Armed Services and Homeland Security Committees, and she is the chair of the Homeland Security Subcommittee on Intelligence and Counterterrorism. Now, Congresswoman Slotkin's earlier career is incredibly impressive. She was a CIA analyst and intelligence briefer, during which she spent 3 tours in Iraq. The Congresswoman also worked at the White House, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and the State Department. She also later joined the Department of Defense, serving in crucial policy positions, most notably as Acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. Congresswoman, I could certainly go on, but thank you very much for joining us today. As a fellow Michigander and Cranbrook alum, this is a very special treat for me.
Glad to be here. Thanks for doing this.
Congresswoman, I echo Ryan's sentiments, except for the Cranbrook alum part of that. But thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Certainly, there are many, many things you are dealing with, especially with your committee and subcommittee assignments. And we're going to dig into that a bit. But first, we want to talk a bit about the events at the Capitol on January 6th. So we've seen violent incidences like this in many other countries, but I don't think any of us really ever expected it to occur at home. However, did you expect this? Did you sort of see this coming? Given the rise of far-right domestic extremism, was it inevitable?
Well, I don't think it was inevitable, but I certainly knew even at that time that there was going to be violence that day. And that's because in Michigan, we've been dealing with this problem for a while, certainly in a heightened way for the past year. I represent Lansing, Michigan, our state capital, and we had armed protesters push their way in April of last year. I mean, you know, sort of early. And we've seen a precipitous rise in hate groups and militias. And it, you know, the plot to kidnap and kill our governor came, unfortunately, out of my district. So we had seen it rising, frankly. And when I saw just all the chatter about the January 6th, protest, I mean, I knew there was going to be violence. I just never imagined it would be inside the Capitol. I thought that we would see violence maybe on the lawn, you know, on the mall. And I was so clear about it that I had given written guidance to my team in the days before that I didn't want anyone coming into work on January 6th, just because I didn't want to have to, you know, have them walk through the crowd. Kind of risk, you know, getting caught in the middle of something on the way from the subway or something. We will have plenty of time to figure out why we so underestimated the threat. But I don't think we had to necessarily inevitably have this happen. I think that it was the combustible mix of groups of folks who have been fed misinformation for years, whose leaders were really encouraging threatening behavior, violent behavior. And then obviously, I'm obviously on the record on this, you know, the president that day specifically inciting the crowd. So I don't think it was inevitable, but I do think January 6th, I really think of it as the end of the post 9/11 era and the beginning of a new era where the division between us as Americans is a greater threat to our security than foreign terrorism, as it has been for the past 20 years.
Absolutely. That's certainly an interesting way to look at it. And so, Congresswoman, how can the Biden administration, in collaboration with Congress, work to kind of overcome the partisanship that may be preventing the United States from dealing with the threat of domestic terrorism from a legislative and regulatory standpoint?
Well, I mean, I think bipartisanship right now is strained, but it still remains critical. And you know, I think, you know, the partisanship that we see right now in the country, yes, there are people who get inspired by that division and climb a ladder of escalation and become domestic terrorists, you know, a small number of people. But I think just as great of a threat is that the partisanship is creating gridlock. I mean, literal constipation in governing. And the average American looks at that and says, my system's not working. My government isn't doing things for me. They're not helping me. They're not changing my situation for me, for my kids. And that is a threat to democracy when people stop believing in it. So what can we do? Well, first of all, we can't give up on it. We can't give up on bipartisanship. And, you know, I think things are so strained. What I tell people is we just have to accept that right now, the best we can do is to just find places where we overlap in our interests. So veterans issues, you know, there's a ton of things that we can still work on to try and put some money in the bank with each other and build back some of that trust. And that's what, you know, we can do legislatively, like, you know, in Congress. But there's also a lot of work that has to go on at the ground level, right? In our communities, because a lot of that trust is broken, you know, in places like my district. I hear about it all the time. So on domestic terrorism specifically, you know, I'm hellbent on making the subcommittee I'm now in charge of, the Intel and Counterterrorism Subcommittee, a place where Democrats and Republicans can have respectful conversation about an important topic. And I have a co-chair who I have spent a lot of time with. He's new. He's a former lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. We know some of the same people. We have folks in common. And I am working with him to set that same tone with the entire committee. And I think on domestic terrorism, there are a lot of issues that intersect with it, but if you focus on the use or threatened use of violence, you know, it's hard for somebody to turn their eyes away from that and not call it domestic terrorism. There's a lot of extremism and other things going on, but if you look and hone in on the use or threatened use of violence for political means, and you like hew close to that definition, my intent, at least, is to try and get overlap and bipartisan agreement to work on that.
So, Congressman, we have a large intelligence community that is well-structured to address so many of these foreign threats, as you well know. But how can the U.S. address domestic threats given constitutional protections such as the First Amendment?
Yeah, you know, this is obviously, it is more complicated on the domestic side, and it should be more complicated on the domestic side, right? And I think that we've just got to really educate ourselves. And I know I've been trying to learn as much as I can. You know, there are lots of states across the country that do have very strong domestic terrorism laws, anti-militia laws. Michigan is one of them. We have some of the best laws on the books to actually deal with these threats. So I think we need to look to where people have these laws and have been using them. And then I think we need to make sure that we're resourced to meet the threat, right? When 9/11 happened, we realized we did not have, you know, enough folks, enough Arabic speakers, enough, you know, smart minds focused on this threat. And then we didn't have the FBI talking to the CIA in the way that was appropriate. We need to do a similar, like really clear-eyed review of our intelligence posture on domestic terrorism with complete respect for civil liberties, but understanding that we need to be resourced against the threat. And, you know, we need to listen to each other. I mean, I can't tell you how many people have reached out to me saying, hey, I'm scared of new domestic terrorism laws because it's just a hop, skip, and a jump until they're going to be used against Black and brown people. I mean, there's a lot of concern, and that's legitimate concern. But you got to also be creative. You know, if we don't end up with another domestic terrorism or a new domestic terrorism law, if that's a bridge too far, let's look at things like the terrorist watch list. You know, how do you get on that thing? And how do you get off? And what happens if you're on? You know, the average American doesn't know that. And I think we saw after January 6th, when we put those, you know, some of those folks on a do not fly list, well, that really pissed them off. I enjoyed that. So I'm interested in looking at things like the terrorist watch list, if that's a way to kind of look at the problem from a different point of view.
Well, thank you, Congresswoman. There are certainly many ways in which the Congress and the federal government can address this threat, but I now want to turn to the Defense Department. And so, Congresswoman, you voiced your concern with the nomination of now confirmed Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. You said, quote, "I'll need to understand what he and the Biden administration plan to do to address my concerns before I can vote for this waiver," close quote. And so, Congresswoman, he is now Secretary of Defense. You voted in favor of this waiver. How did Secretary Austin and the administration adequately address your concerns that led you to vote in favor?
Yeah, I mean, for me, this was a good news story, right? I mean, I have worked with Lloyd Austin for many, many years. He was the commanding general on my third tour in Iraq. He was the head of CENTCOM when I was an assistant secretary. I mean, we have intersected many times, and I have a lot of respect for him. And obviously, it was a historic nomination. But I had qualms about a recently retired general becoming the civilian Secretary of Defense right on the heels of Jim Mattis, another recently retired four-star who also needed a waiver. I mean, at a certain point, you know, if you keep getting waivers, the law becomes a bit irrelevant, right? So I did have concerns, but I must say, we did a couple of things, and Lloyd Austin, now Secretary Austin, really came back with answers. Number one, a group of us wrote him a letter, and we asked for a number of specific things, right? We asked that he dismantle some structures that Jim Mattis had put together that sort of subverted the chain of command on the civilian side. We asked that more civilian leaders be brought in to sort of the most important decision-making bodies at the Pentagon. We asked for him to brief us on any organizational changes he made to make sure he hired qualified civilians and for civilian jobs and not, you know, recently retired military. So we wrote him a letter. And then I hosted a Zoom meeting with him and a number of members of Congress who were also concerned about this issue. He answered our questions. He showed up. And then he came and did a briefing for the House Armed Services Committee, which I'm on, and spoke about his commitment to do many of the things in our letter. So, you know, I know it doesn't seem like it, but this is how, you know, sometimes, but Washington can still work. You know, I had concerns. And he helped alleviate them. And so I voted for him. And in a perfect world, we would be doing more of that, right? Pushing our leaders, one branch pushing on the other, and then having comity once we have a conversation. So that's how I got to the point of voting for him and encouraging others to vote for him.
Congresswoman, I now want to move into the issue of Iran. So we already know that the Biden administration wants to negotiate or renegotiate with Iran on a revised nuclear deal after having left the JCPOA under the Trump administration. But we also see Iranian activity, military activity with regards to, you know, areas in the region, for example, Syria. So how does the Biden administration address Iran's regional goals and broader strategy to limit U.S. influence?
Yeah, I mean, this might be an area where a topic where I have a little bit of a different view than maybe some in the Biden administration. Obviously, Iran's nuclear program is the preeminent threat that they pose to the world, to the region, to the rest of the world. There's a lot of threats coming out of Iran, but that's the big kahuna, you know, is their nuclear program. And I supported the JCPOA when we drafted it under the Obama administration. But I don't think it was ever meant to be the only agreement we have with Iran. And we have to deal with their ballistic missile program and their terrorism. And as someone who has lost friends to Iranian rockets and missiles that have been fired at us from Iraq, I mean, we can't stop at just dealing with their nuclear program. So I support the idea of trying to find a way to get to negotiations. I just think it needs to now include that roadmap to deal with the ballistic missiles and the terrorism. And frankly, I mean, Donald Trump had maximum leverage that he could have exerted to get this. He was threatening to pull out and threatening to pull out and threatening to pull out. And the Europeans and the Iranians were, you know, they probably would have done anything to keep him in. And so that would have been the moment to say, well, let's get in some additional negotiations, a new deal on ballistic missiles, another deal on terrorism, stack them up like Legos so that we have a truly robust set of agreements that move the ball forward. And, you know, my hope is that the Biden administration, who was dealt a tough hand on this since Trump pulled out, that they realized 4 years does make a difference. And that when we go back to the negotiating table, they get a commitment, a public commitment from the Iranians that we're going to also negotiate on ballistic missiles and terrorism.
So, Congresswoman, let's turn to Congress. The Democratic Party has experienced notable internal debates about the trajectory of U.S. foreign policy. Some have called for isolationism, whereas others have called for liberalism, whereby the U.S. will champion its values abroad. But where do you fall on this debate? As someone who has actually served their country both at home and overseas, what should U.S. foreign policy look like? And has your perspective changed since becoming a member of Congress?
Well, that yes, the answer to that last question is my perspective has definitely changed. I mean, I was a national security nerd, you know, a wonk. That's what I was trained to do. That's what I did. And I really believe in a strong American leadership role in the world. And while I am the first one to say that we've made mistakes, you know, I served three tours in Iraq. It's impossible for someone of my generation to say that the United States hasn't made fundamental mistakes abroad. But I'd still put our leadership, principled leadership, ahead of China, Russia, and anyone else who would come and fill in the vacuum. And let me tell you, there is and will be a vacuum if the United States doesn't take that leadership role. So I believe in a strong American role. Obviously, the best way to do it is by living through our principles and our values. We have not always done that abroad, but that's still the best thing to aim for. And for me, I think I just take very seriously as they call it, as a 9/11 baby, you know, someone who came into national service after 9/11 and because of 9/11, the fundamental responsibility is to protect Americans, is to protect us from harm, protect threats to our way of life. That is not always sunshine and rainbows. We can't just will ourselves into a safe country. It takes work by serious professionals who know how to do this. And no one would ever say we get everything right. But I also am not willing to accept a foreign policy perspective that's just based on pulling back from the world, on disengaging, on saying we shouldn't be engaged in the world, we should be focused here. Because one day that will come back to bite us, and one day soon. So I can't support a kind of isolationist pullback from the world. But man, has my perspective on this changed as a congresswoman. And I think the most important thing that I tell my friends who are still national security wonks and protecting the country every single day is that we haven't communicated to the country on why this stuff is really important, on how we keep people safe, why it's critical we keep doing things. You know, we haven't explained ourselves. And foreign policy people tend to talk to other foreign policy people. And so we talk to each other and we write articles and we write in journals and maybe we talk to foreign policy people in other countries. But try explaining, as I had to do, why the sudden pullout of Syria that Donald Trump ordered a couple of years ago, you know, leaving the Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, in the fight against ISIS. Try explaining that to my dad, who's in the hot dog business, why that's important. And my dad's not a dumb guy. He's a smart guy. He's just not a foreign policy guy. And so I had to have the experience of communicating wonky foreign policy things to people who didn't grow up in that industry. And that's a very different way to communicate. And foreign policy people just have lived for 60 years not having to explain themselves. Foreign policy elites have really dictated the direction of our foreign policy without the consent of the American people. And the American people largely were fine with that. And now they're not. You know, in your generation, the younger generation, the generation that has come of age after 9/11, you know, a lot of the folks that I represent at Michigan State will say, well, I think when the America engages abroad, it's just we're bad at it. We shouldn't do it. You know, they don't understand what we're doing abroad. And that's on the foreign policy community to take that as a lesson. And lastly, I will just say, as a congressperson, I see very clearly that we are only as strong abroad as we are united at home. And when we are divided as we are now, the ability for us to go out into the world and say, well, let us tell you what the American perspective is, or let me tell you what deal we want to cut or what agreement or treaty we want to negotiate. It would only be normal right now for another country to hedge and say, okay, sure, I get that this is what you want for the next 4 years, but who knows how the pendulum's going to swing when the next guy comes in. Because they see how divided we are. So we've got to take care of that division at home if we want to be a strong leader abroad.
Congresswoman, you raised so many good points, especially about communicating these complex foreign policy ideas to the population, to the people, so they can actually understand these. So those are all very good points. And I just wanted to make one follow-up to the question we just had before. So you're a very unique person, I think, in the Democratic Party. You've given many interviews and statements on, say, domestic policies of the Democratic Party and what the future of the Democratic Party looks like. But with regards to foreign policy and national security, where do you see that going for the Democratic Party in the next decade?
Well, to be honest, I mean, if you look around at the people who were freshmen with me in 2018, there's actually, I mean, I think they even have a name for us, right? It's like National Security Dems. I mean, there's a lot of us with a military background or an intelligence background. You know, I hope that that's folks with similar backgrounds decide to run in all kinds of levels of government, because I think that it's positive. So I think foreign policy is definitely an issue of debate within the Democratic Party. You know, I guess for me, I think that it is important when we're thinking about making major decisions on foreign policy or funding or defunding major things on foreign policy, that we get to spend some time with people who have actually had to do it, who actually know how to protect us. And what I sometimes have a hard time stomaching is when people have textbook idealized ideas of what our foreign policy can be without ever being responsible for protecting another human life. When that is your responsibility, when that is your name that you're signing to the memo for a new action, for some kind of move, when you're an ambassador and you're in charge of, you know, the safety of American people in a country, you better believe that changes your perspective. And so I don't know where we will end up, but I do know that I am going to be a strong voice for the practitioners, for the people who have actually had to be responsible for other people and their safety. I think we'd be better served as a party if we were influenced by experience.
Congresswoman, as we begin to close out this conversation, I just wanted to ask, given your experience in the intelligence community and now as a member of Congress, what do you see as the biggest underappreciated threats that belie the United States?
Well, like I said, I think the division between us, I think that we're not really yet absorbing how this threatens us. We all know what a domestic terrorist looked like, and we all know why that would be a threat. But, you know, if you're the average citizen living in, you know, Brighton, Michigan, and you're watching the TV and trying to understand what your government is doing and what it can do to improve your life and the lives of your kids, you're looking at the gridlock and you're losing hope. You're losing hope that this democracy works. If you're working a job 40 hours a week, but you can't cover your healthcare bills or your prescription drugs, you literally are rationing your insulin so that you can make, you know, it stretch further for a month. I mean, that is a threat to your family. And you look at the bickering that's going on and you just shake your head. I think that people are not absorbing what it means if the next generation doesn't believe in democracy. That is such a dangerous thing. So I think that's being undervalued, and we're still kind of processing that. I think people aren't realizing that the partisanship that they see on their TV coming out of Washington is playing out in places like my district in a very personal, on the ground way. Neighbors shouting at neighbors, teachers and parents getting into it. You know, we've got a problem right now in my district with Zoom bombing, where people come onto a Zoom and flash pictures of the KKK giving the Nazi salute and threaten, you know, the pastor, the city mayor, you know, just terrible, terrible things. So what you see on TV plays out in the real world in a very disturbing way that results in people asking me constantly, like, how do we get better? How do we improve? While most of America may live in either a very blue place or a very red place, for those of us who still live in very mixed political places, it's this tension is just not good for us.
Congresswoman, on that note, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a very fascinating conversation, a very insightful conversation. You are a very important voice in our national security discourse, and it's a great thing that you're on the Hill sort of advancing your viewpoints and so on. So thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And thank you for your service as well, not just in Congress, but in the intelligence community with our armed services and so on. So thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.